Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and our guest this evening is Joanne Richards. But now that I'm looking at my notes, it dawns on me that she won't be calling in till about 8:30. So what I'm going to do is play a few clips, and we'll see if she calls in around 8:30, and if she doesn't, I'll give her a call, and I think I have her number somewhere. She should know she should call in. I'm going to play some information on some clips related to the whole North Korea strike on Guam, a potential war that we seem to be getting ready to head into, and then that'll lead us right into Joanne Richards coming on and talking about her husband, Mark Richards, who spent a time in the Secret Space Program.
And Cecilia Vega is with us live tonight from Bedminster, New Jersey, where the president is vacationing at his golf course. And Cecilia, you have more on that statement from the North Koreans at this hour than anyone from the White House tonight?
David, no response from the White House because the statement literally just came in. I want to read a little bit to you. It is from a top Army commander given to us by state media, given out by state media. They say that it is, and they outright say that this is a crucial warning to the United States, calling that fire and fury comment by President Trump a load of nonsense. They say that this has infuriated the Army. They list the exact rockets that they plan to use to fire at Guam, David, and they say this plan will be complete by mid-August.
The administration will have to decide whether some sort of preemptive strike or some other measure should be undertaken to stop Kim.
That headline, North Korea just a short time ago issuing its newest threat. The AP now reporting that the North Korean regime is calling President Trump's words a load of nonsense, saying they will complete their plan to, quote, attack waters near Guam by mid-August. It comes after President Trump warned North Korea against making any more threats, or the U.S. would unleash fire and fury unlike anything the world has ever seen. ABC senior White House correspondent Sylvia Vega leading us off.
Tonight, a new threat from North Korea coming in, saying they will be ready to attack the U.S. territory of Guam by mid-August. This comes as President Trump's warning shot fired directly at Pyongyang tonight is sending shockwaves around the world. But ABC News has learned That threat caught some in the president's own inner circle by surprise. The president, in that statement, using language not vetted or pre-approved by his national security team.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Sources close to the president say behind closed doors with top aides, including new Chief of Staff General John Kelly, President Trump had discussed taking a tougher tone on Pyongyang. But even members of his own national security team had no idea the president would go so far.
He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
Within a few hours, North Korea responding with its own warning, saying it is seriously considering a plan to target Guam with missiles. The U.S. territory, home to crucial military bases and 160,000 Americans, is just 2,000 miles away. The Pentagon has prepared a specific strike plan for a preemptive attack on North Korea should the president order one. Key to that plan, two senior military officials and two senior retired officers tell us, the battle-tested B-1 bomber, seen here in a military video, training for such a mission. The B-1, recently updated, has been a workhorse in Afghanistan and Iraq. Since the end of May, the B-1s have accelerated their training, conducted 11 practice runs, including one on Monday.
You have a new book coming out, The America We Deserve, which I've had a chance to, had some excerpts given to me by your office. Let me talk about some of the issues. One is North Korea, and you say that you, as president, would be willing to launch a preemptive strike against North Korea's nuclear capability.
First, I'd negotiate. I would negotiate like crazy, and I'd make sure that we tried to get the best deal possible. Look, Tim. If a man walks up to you in the street in Washington, because this doesn't happen, of course, in New York, but if a man walks up and puts a gun to your head and says, give me your money, wouldn't you rather know where he's coming from before he had the gun in his hand? And these people, in 3 or 4 years, when we have nuclear weapons, they're going to have those weapons pointed all over the world and specifically at the United States. And wouldn't you be better off solving this really potentially unbelievable, and the biggest problem, I mean, we can talk about the economy, we can talk about social security. The biggest problem this world has is nuclear proliferation.
Six B-1s are positioned in Guam. They are not nuclear capable. Here's what they're training for. Pairs of B-1s supported overhead by satellites and drones, surrounded by fighter jets, as well as refueling and electronic warfare planes, have flown round trips, refueling multiple times, to practice what a real operation against North Korean missile sites might look like. The highly sophisticated strike package is designed to be largely invisible to facilitate a sneak attack. The targets, multiple sources say, approximately 2 dozen North Korean missile launch sites and support facilities, which intelligence officials tell NBC News they feel confident they have accurately identified. The B-1s can carry a mix of weapons, as many as 168 bombs, or more likely, the new JASSM-ER, a highly accurate missile that can be fired hundreds of miles outside North Korean airspace.
Of all the military options you could consider, this would be one of the two or three that would be at least have a possibility of not escalating the situation. A single long-range strike against the nuclear program, a cyber offensive would be the second. Those are the only two military options that ought to be in serious consideration.
Nonetheless, Admiral Stavridis, who is the supreme allied commander of NATO, says he would counsel the president against the use of the U.S. military at this point.
Kim Jong-un would be compelled to respond. He would lash out militarily at a minimum against South Korea and potentially at longer range targets, perhaps including Guam. That's a bad set of outcomes from where we sit today.
And we have a country out there in North Korea, which is sort of wacko, which is not a bunch of dummies, and they are going out and they are developing nuclear weapons. And they're not doing it because they're having fun doing it. They're doing it for a reason. And wouldn't it be good to sit down and really negotiate something and ideally negotiate. Now, if that negotiation doesn't work, you better solve the problem now than solve it later, Tim. And you know it, and every politician knows it, and nobody wants to talk about it. Jimmy Carter, who I really like, he went over there, he was so soft. These people are laughing at us.
The former general of the Air Force, Merrill McKee, the former Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin, said you could not launch a preemptive strike against North Korea because the nuclear fallout could be devastating to the Asian Peninsula.
I'm not talking about us using nuclear weapons.
Then the president himself weighed in, tweeting, "Our nuclear arsenal is now far stronger and more powerful than ever before. Hopefully, we will never have to use this power." But his initial words have sparked international reaction. From New Zealand,
"I think the comments are not helpful in an environment that's very tense."
To Germany's foreign office, saying saber rattling won't help. Even some in the president's own party calling his words dangerous.
"All it's going to do is bring us closer to some kind of serious confrontation. I think this is very, very, very serious. The great leaders that I've seen, they don't threaten unless they are ready to act."
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that President Trump is ready to act.
I'm saying that they have areas where they're developing missiles.
Yeah, but taking out their nuclear potential
country
would create a fallout.
Tim, do you know that this country went out and gave them nuclear reactors, free fuel for 10 years? We virtually tried to bribe them into stopping, and they're continuing to do what they're doing, and they're laughing at us. They think we're a bunch of dummies. I'm saying that we have to do something to stop.
But if the military told you, "Mr. Trump, we can't do this."
You're giving me two names. I don't know. You want to do it in 5 years when they have warheads all over the place, every one of them pointing to New York City, to Washington, and every one of us? Is that when you want to do it, or do you want to do something now? You better do it now. And if they think you're serious, I deal with lots of people. If they think you're serious, they'll negotiate, and it'll never come to that.
A flurry of recent missile tests by North Korea has set nerves on edge and stirred fresh concern about whether U.S. defenses could protect Americans against a sneak attack. North Korea has detonated nuclear devices and is trying to develop long-range missiles capable of reaching the United States. The Pentagon has spent more than $40 billion on the ground-based mid-course defense system, GMD for short. It's designed specifically to thwart a nuclear strike by North Korea or Iran. Yet there are grave doubts about whether it's up to the task. Here is a look at the system's origins, how it's supposed to work, and the technical problems that have bedeviled it. It's designed to defend the United States against a limited nuclear attack. That means a strike with a handful of missiles, as opposed to a massive assault of the kind that Russia or China could launch. The United States relies on deterrence, the threat of overwhelming retaliation, to prevent Russia or China from ever unleashing missiles against us. In the case of North Korea or Iran, we would rely on GMD to knock incoming warheads out of the sky. By intercepting incoming warheads in space, just as they're about to begin their re-entry into the atmosphere, That's the approximate mid-course point in a warhead's journey from launch pad to target. The GMD interceptors are 60-foot tall, three-stage rockets. Each has a 5-foot, 150-pound kill vehicle at its tip. In the event of an attack, interceptors would be launched from their underground silos. Once in space, the kill vehicles would separate from their boost rockets and fly independently toward their targets, at speeds up to 4 miles per second. There are 37 operational interceptors, 4 at Vandenberg Air Force Base in Santa Barbara County, California, and 33 at F.T. Greeley, Alaska. The kill vehicles carry no explosives. They're designed to destroy enemy warheads with kinetic energy, or energy of motion. In other words, by crashing into them. Satellites and powerful radars, stationed on land and at sea, track airborne objects. The GMD system receives data from these and other sources and would use it to guide the interceptors. The kill vehicle also has an onboard navigation system to help it zero in on its target. Intercepting a warhead traveling at hypersonic speed is a supreme technical challenge. It's been compared to hitting one speeding bullet with another. GMD has not shown that it could do that dependably. The system has performed poorly in flight tests, and technical problems keep cropping up. In 9 simulated attacks since GMD was deployed in 2004, interceptors have failed to take out their targets 6 times. And the flight tests are much less challenging than an actual attack would be. They're carefully scripted for success. The operating personnel know ahead of time when mock warheads will be launched, as well as their size, speed, and approximate trajectory. They don't assume that. To the contrary, defense planners assume that 4 or 5 GMD interceptors would have to be launched for every incoming warhead to have a good chance of destroying them all, according to current and former government officials. That's called the shot doctrine, and it reflects GMD's shortcomings. It means that if an adversary launched multiple missiles, our inventory of interceptors could be quickly depleted. It's no single problem, it's a variety of causes. And that's what so concerns experts who've studied the system. In some cases, divert thrusters were blamed. These are small rocket motors, 4 of which are attached to each kill vehicle. They're supposed to fire rapidly to make course corrections and keep the kill vehicle on course once it's in space and flying on its own. In some tests, the thruster's rough combustion of fuel was found to have thrown off the kill vehicle's onboard guidance system. A lot of time and money was spent redesigning the thrusters to kill this problem. In January 2016, a flight test was initiated from Vandenberg Air Force Base to check out the new thrusters. The Missile Defense Agency and its lead contractors pronounced the test a success. But as the Times later reported, it wasn't. Partway through the exercise, one of the new thrusters stopped working, and the kill vehicle veered far off course. A review overseen by the missile agency found that the thruster most likely malfunctioned because of a glitch in the circuit board that powered it. As the Times reported, circuit boards in most of the kill vehicles now in the GMD fleet are vulnerable to the same kind of mishap. Bottom line, the kill vehicles are tremendously complex machines. Each one has more than 1,000 components. And because of the speed with which they've been produced and deployed, no two are identical. American scientists had been working on missile defense technology for decades, with the aim of creating a reliable shield for the U.S. homeland. President Clinton, whose administration supported and funded such research, concluded that the technology wasn't ready for prime time. But his successor, President George W. Bush, had campaigned on a promise to deploy a homeland missile defense system quickly, asserting that the country was in imminent danger of a sneak attack by a rogue state such as North Korea or Iran. In late 2002, Bush ordered the Pentagon to field a set of missile defense capabilities by the end of 2004. To speed things along, Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld exempted the program from the Pentagon's normal procurement and testing standards. Analysts trace GMD's problems to these early decisions to prioritize speed above meticulous engineering and development of proven capabilities. The Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan investigative arm of Congress, reported last year that GMD's test record has been insufficient to demonstrate that an operationally useful defense capability exists. In July, a team of missile defense experts who studied GMD for the Union of Concerned Scientists said the system is simply unable to protect the U.S. public. In January, the Pentagon's Operational Test and Evaluation Office, in its annual report on U.S. defense programs, rated GMD's reliability as low. It said the day-to-day availability, or readiness, of the system's interceptors was also low. The report added that flight tests had revealed unspecified new failure modes. The agency says it is absolutely confident in GMD's ability to protect the homeland. A handful of defense contractors have produced the system's major elements. Raytheon Company has built the kill vehicles and radars. Orbital ATK Incorporated has made the boost rockets. Northrop Grumman Corporation has provided the worldwide communications links. Boeing Company has managed GMD as the government's prime contractor. Some generals have said the cost of an interceptor-based system is unsustainable, and that the U.S. needs to give greater thought to a left-of-launch strategy. That's military speak for taking out missiles before they could be launched, as opposed to trying to shoot them out of the sky. Yet for now, the Pentagon is expanding GMD to 44 interceptors, with bipartisan support from Congress. This is not a Trump initiative, it started under President Obama. The government is also studying possible sites for a third interceptor field in the eastern half of the U.S. that would add up to 60 interceptors to the GMD fleet.
U.S. weapons are locked and loaded, Donald Trump has tweeted in his latest warning to North Korea. And this is after the president refused to back down on his threat to bring fire and fury to Pyongyang amid global calls for de-escalation. RT's Jacqueline Vuga reports from Washington.
When his comments of threatening fire and fury against North Korea were called into question, Trump hit back, saying maybe they in fact weren't tough enough.
Frankly, the people that were questioning that statement, was it too tough? Maybe it wasn't tough enough. North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Now, when asked what could be tougher than fire and fury, Trump gave the sinister response of you'll see, leaving everyone frightened that physical action could be the next step in this war of words. Trump also warned Pyongyang that they'd be sorry if they even considered attacking the U.S. or any of its allies.
If North Korea does anything in terms of even thinking about attack of anybody that we love or we represent or our allies or us, they can be very, very nervous. I'll tell you what, and they should be very nervous because things will happen to them like they never thought possible. North Korea better get their act together or they're going to be in trouble like few nations ever have been in trouble.
Now, such statements as these coming from the president have been slammed by a number of American senators who see them as reckless, causing significantly more harm than good.
President Trump is not helping the situation with his bombastic comments.
We need to be firm and deliberate with North Korea. But reckless rhetoric is not a strategy to keep America safe.
I think it was just the wrong message and elevated the situation rather than showing the international community that there is hope for a diplomatic solution.
Unfortunately, it is unlikely that those words will affect Trump's rhetoric, however, meaning the possibility of a democratic resolution is slipping away, seemingly pushing the world closer and closer to the edge of war.
North Korea, in its turn, slammed Trump's comments as being nonsense, and it went on to say that no serious dialogue is possible with the president, who it described as being a guy bereft of reason. Earlier, Pyongyang claimed that it was preparing plans to fire four missiles near the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam. We spoke to a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He says that such threats put Trump on the same level as North Korea's leader.
I don't see the plus in these threats. where are we getting something in return from these presidents' threats? I don't see it. I've never seen the tension so high in the Korean Peninsula. I'm extremely concerned. I hope the president's advisors rein him in. General Kelly, you know, the new chief of staff, he's got to tell the president, you can't conduct foreign policy the way you're doing, with words, with fiery words. Exchanges stooping to the level of Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans, who generate this rhetoric almost every day. But this rhetoric has gotten a lot more intense also from the North Korean side.
Russia's foreign minister has said that the risk of the U.S.-North Korea tensions turning into war is high. Artizilia Petrenka has more.
Sergei Lavrov has said that nothing can be decided through war, and that in the case of North Korea, a potential military conflict can be enormously dangerous.
I think that the risks are very high, especially considering the rhetoric. There are direct threats of force, with U.S. Secretary of Defense Mattis once again stating that there'd be a huge number of casualties. I think when a fight is brewing, the first step back from the danger line should be taken by the stronger and smarter side.
The Russian foreign minister here was referring to the statements by the U.S. Secretary of Defense. Just to remind you, we heard Mr. Mattis warning Pyongyang against the actions that could, quote, lead to the destruction of its people. So it was a part of a warning, yet he still said these words out loud, a destruction of a nation. So things are getting as serious as they can ever get. Now, in the meantime, some of America's main allies in Europe, the likes of the UK and Germany, they're calling on the American president.
Well, folks, we got some interesting current events going on, that's for sure. Some crazy times. And I have a caller, but I'm not sure if this is Joanne. But I'll go ahead and bring him on the air. Is this Joanne Richards?
Yes, it is.
Thanks for calling in a little early. I started the show.
Oh, sure. I started the show. Glad I checked my email.
Oh, you did check your email. Good.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So how have you been?
I'm good. Busy, but good. Really good.
Why don't
how are you?
You start out? I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic.
Good.
Why don't you start out, since you haven't been on the show for a while, and I'm sure we've got a bunch of new listeners, so I thought it might be good if you could kind of tell them about your husband and about the current situation and tell them a little bit about yourself and stuff like that.
Sure. All right, where to begin? Okay, let's see. By day, I am a bookkeeper. By night and by every spare moment, I run this great nonprofit called Earth Defense Headquarters, and the overall parameters are to do research about little-known history, and I focus a lot on military history and cryptozoology and magical arts, things like that, creative stuff, stuff that you're not going to hear on the mainstream news and in your school textbooks, technically. I'm based in Northern California, just north of San Francisco. Let's see, I have a grown daughter and three wonderful grandchildren. My husband, Captain Mark Richards, is a Navy captain, and he and his dad both did military intelligence throughout their whole military careers, and he has some interesting relatives, and his grandfather's worked with scientists like Tesla and Hubble and Goddard and all kinds of cool people, and the thing especially that I've been talking about the last several years is that Mark has been around aliens his whole life. And that's pretty much was the focus of his military career. So he has written about several things he's been involved with or been around and different species he's had contact with and, you know, combat, all that kind of stuff, and just some really interesting information about them. And the sad thing is that 35 years ago, he was arrested for masterminding a murder he had nothing to do with, and he's been in prison ever since. So he's getting old for prison. We're really tired of prison, but I've been with him for almost 20 years. We've been married for 15 years. And, you know, we just keep plodding along and doing our stuff here and getting the information out. And We're hoping that one of these days soon there will be something that changes in the legal system that would make it easier for him to come home. So that's easier said than done, but, you know, we're still hoping. So
has your husband ever talked about what's going on with Trump and this whole thing with Kim Jong-un from North Korea? And it almost sounds like we're on the brink of a nuclear war.
He hasn't elaborated a lot. He has, you know, said that the guy has threatened to nuke Seattle or, you know, something along the West Coast. He didn't mention that he threatened to nuke San Francisco, which is fine because my daughter lives up by Seattle, so I don't want him to nuke there either. I don't want him to nuke anywhere. But, you know, the guy's a loose cannon, and it's going to be interesting to see how Trump plays that out and how his military advisors, you know, how much influence they have over him. We haven't spent a lot of time. We don't spend a lot of time talking about the president for good reasons, because I keep saying, well, couldn't you Republicans think of somebody better to put in, you know, as your candidate? And he said, no, there wasn't anybody any better. Like, great. So,
now your husband has talked about reptilians a lot. Why don't you give listeners a little bit of a background on what that's all about?
Sure. Well, before Mark was born, this is one of my fun stories. Before Mark was born, his dad and his mom were at the Officers Club swimming pool at Hamilton Air Force Base, which is just north of where I live. It's about 15, 20 minutes north. It's now a closed base. It's all housing. But anyway, back in its heyday, it was a fabulous Air Force Base. And I think, anyway, you know, right around the time, before Mark was born. Anyway, so like that summer before he was born, all the officers and their wives were at a pool, and several flying saucers came into view, and the alarms went off, and the wives had to obviously just stay there while their husbands ran down to their planes or their jets and go deal with these flying saucers because they didn't know what they were there for. And Mark's dad comes out of his hangar in a flying saucer, one of many which the Air Force had built for them. And, you know, the officer's wife, or the base commander's wife, is going, now, ladies, you know, we are not going to talk about this. Just be calm. And so, you know, everybody comes back, and eventually one more flying saucer comes back, and out walks a velociraptor-type reptilian. We call them raptors. And he is an ambassador from the Draconian Empire. And he's Prince Naga that became really good friends with Mark's dad and Mark later. And so, you know, he started teaching the military people all kinds of stuff about space and whatever. And their empire had decided it was time to, you know, try and become allies with the humans. And, you know, their empire has been our allies since the early 50s. And before that, they weren't, and they were still eating us and everything, but they've learned not to eat us unless they really have to, but that's not as often as it used to be. So when Mark was born, the raptors knew who he was. They came and honored his birth a couple months later, and when he got a little bit older, 1961, he was allowed to be at an interspecies conference that took place in England. And he was 7, almost 8 at the time, and he got to meet this Prince Naga and two of his children. And immediately, you know, once you get over the fact that they look scary as heck, they became really good friends. And he, you know, the boy, the son, the male raptor, became Mark's best friend. And they were friends for years until in combat Craig died. And the sister, she's now their empress. So he's been very close to these raptors, especially, you know, the ruling family. He's been close to them for years, and Prince Naga is still alive, and he's back on the earth, and there's thousands of raptors here. And if you watch the Jurassic World movies, that's exactly what they look like. And you know, some of the things we might talk about tonight are when Mark was training with them as a teenager, even before he got out of high school. So, yeah, it's fast. And I wish I could show the pictures that I have, but we're not doing a video interview here. So anyway, he's been around them for a long time. He's taught us a lot about like their family structure and their military structure and their philosophical beliefs, that kind of stuff. So I know a lot about them.
Now, are you saying that you have photographs of the raptors?
I don't have photographs. I have drawings. And
okay.
Then, you know, if you watch, I have some drawings that his English girlfriend drew from that England conference in 1961, because she was there as well. And then I have drawings now that Mark has done about some of his raptor friends. So, because you know, you can't really be walking around with a camera, and he was a kid back in 1961, so that was the last thing on his mind, besides the camera would have been confiscated. Yeah, they didn't take any notice of the little girl doing drawings, and maybe she waited till that night to do them. And I don't know how that all worked out, but you know, you just don't walk around with a camera at these top secret meetings, and you know, so yeah, camera was out of the question. But I do have lots of their drawings, but if you watch the Jurassic World movie, they're very much like that. So they're very intelligent.
Have you ever wondered if they're really real, because I mean we haven't seen any photographs or any films or anything like that?
Well, no, I don't wonder at all. I completely trust my husband that he's, you know, not telling me a fairy tale.
Okay.
You know, after this long, you know, 20 years, if I can't trust him now, we're in deep trouble. But the fact is, you know, there are treaties in place against open communication between civilians and humans. So, you know, you're not supposed to go around showing actual pictures of these things. And when they, you know, go to different events and stuff, you know, they're not likely, you know, people think they're in costume, and, you know, maybe somebody's taken a picture of them and they just think that thing's in a great costume. But, you know, they're usually not out and about amongst the general public, like especially during the day. So, yeah.
Do these raptors speak English then?
Some of them do. The more elite of them are allowed to have operations on their voice boxes so they can speak different human languages. So I know when I first started hearing about Prince Naga, Mark was saying, well, he could speak, you know, 16 languages or 16 human languages. And Mark knows several human languages, and he also can speak raptor fluently, and he can speak some kind of oceanic language and who knows what else. And then a lot of creatures communicate telepathically, and he can do that. So,
you know, your
no
connections
communicating.
Your connection, your connection's breaking up a little bit, Joanne.
Oh no!
Yeah. You were fine in the beginning. Let's push ahead, and if it continues,
okay.
I'll have you call back in.
Okay.
So, how old is Prince Naga at this point?
I've lost track, but he's probably around 140, 150.
And what's the length of these raptors' lifespans? 1,000 years or something like that?
I don't know if they live that long. I know I have one of my favorite quotes that I always give. Well, I give it most of my talks. The senator that gave it at a conference in 1971 was 300 years old.
So, wow.
I don't know
wow.
how much past that they live, but they get up there.
Joanne, if you don't mind, why don't you call back in real quick? It's still kind
okay.
of bad.
Breaking up?
Hey.
Okay. Bye. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Bye. Ah, okay. Joanne dropped off, and I don't know why. Usually she has a pretty good connection. Sometimes that happens. It's very interesting, this whole idea of reptilians. I think the whole UFO community is very much I would say 90 to 95% of people just take it as on its face. I think that, Joanne, how are you?
Yep, I'm good. I'm back.
Gosh, that is a little, it's just still kind of shaky a little bit.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, usually you have a real good connection.
I don't know what to tell you.
I do have your home phone, if it hasn't changed. I could try calling you.
What is it? Which number is that? What does it end with?
It ends with a 1 and an 8. Does that not ring a bell? It's kind of old. It might be old.
Oh, that must be old. Yeah. No, that's not it. Do you want me to email it to you really quickly?
You could.
Okay.
Go ahead and do
Hang
that.
On a minute. Yeah. Okay. Hang on.
See if it'll make it a little better.
Okay.
It could be me. Oh, I got it. Here we go. Just
Is
a
it
second.
You?
I hope it's not me. It could be. I got one of your emails. It was an older one here.
Oh,
it said
I
you would call in early. Oh, got another one. Okay. All right, good. Let me give this number a call and hopefully.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll call you. All righty.
Okay.
Thanks. Thanks. It could be me, though. I don't know. It's hard to tell sometimes. All right. Here we go, folks. All right. 415-978. Here we go. Hello?
Hello.
Hey there, that's better. Yay.
Oh, good. Okay.
We got a good connection. I don't usually when you call in you're fine, but I'm glad we got a good connection now. We were talking about Naga, and you were saying that sometimes they have operations on their throat, and in order to insert some kind of technology that allows them to speak.
Well,
you know, there was a guy.
I don't know the details of that operation. So
I don't either, but I heard a guy. Probably been 6-7 years ago, maybe even longer, probably longer. And I don't remember his name. He was a guy from the UK that said he had been to some of the underground bases and that he had seen these reptilians 8 or 9 foot tall. He said, if you looked him in the eye, you were in serious danger. You never looked him in the eye. You always kind of kept your head down and your gaze down. And he said they had, some of them had something like a device that was inserted into their throat so that they could speak. Very similar to what you're describing. Now,
well,
I don't know whatever
happened
to that fella. I forget his name.
Oh.
I don't know whatever happened to that fella.
Uh-huh.
I forget his name, but I remember watching those videos. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I always like to point out that there are numerous types of reptilians. People tend to lump them all in one bucket, and they're very different. So the raptors originated here on Earth, and they're unlike any other reptilian, as far as I'm concerned. But there is a species that evolved from them after an asteroid hit the planet, you know, millions of years ago, and they are more human-like. But and then there's several that are originated from space, like the Dracos, and then some that I've kind of seen drawings of, but I've never heard of them. But the raptors, they don't generally walk upright. They generally, because they have a very long tail and it's heavy, and they're more balanced if they're in running stance. So, you know, their head and chest would be almost like level with their tail so that they're perfectly balanced because they're made for running. If they did stand upright, they would be, you know, 7 to 9 feet tall. But generally, in their T position,
their hips might be only like 2 or 3 feet high, you know. But so they don't generally walk around like humans do. I mean, they can stand up, but they don't generally prefer that, I don't think. They're running machines.
So you're saying that a raptor would be on all fours normally?
Generally. Or maybe they just run with not all fours, because their two forearms aren't nearly as sturdy and, you know, big as their legs. They just run with their legs, but they're not running upright like a human would. They're more, you know, their head and chest are, you know, so that their head and chest are in line with their tail, so they look like a T.
Mm-hmm.
That's, mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, just again, and I don't remember, the ones in Jurassic World, they probably had their heads up more than maybe they do normally, but it's just my impression that they are more balanced if they're in more of a T formation with their body. So that their tail, they're just all balanced that way.
So according to what your husband has said, in our ancient past, 100 million years ago, I guess, some of these dinosaur types developed intelligence and eventually developed technology to the level that they could literally leave the Earth, and didn't some of them, or a good portion of them, actually go out into space for some time?
Right. The majority of them are out in space now. They left the planet millions of years ago. And you have to understand, the raptors, they are very intelligent, but technology is not, I mean, they're very good with technology, but they don't necessarily want to take the time to develop it. So they'll borrow, if for being nice, they'll borrow technology. You know, if somebody's just landed with the spacecraft, they might just borrow it. And they'll use somebody else's technology and figure out how to use it. I don't know how much time they spend on building their own craft and whatever. They have some amazing spacecraft, and they do use computers and machinery to build things off planet. But they will also borrow things and then learn how to use it. And, you know, but yes, millions of years ago, lots of the ones that were here on the Earth went out into space to colonize, and they have a vast empire out there somewhere in our arm of the galaxy. And, you know, they've terraformed several planets, and I don't know exactly where they are, but they have a home world out there, and this is their mother world, so they really value Earth still and want to help protect it, and they do.
So you were saying that they really don't necessarily like to spend a lot of time developing technology. So
I don't think they sit around in labs developing a lot of their own technology, but they certainly know how to use it. You know, they're very good at computers and different things. So, and obviously they have to know how to navigate their ships, so they're able to do all that.
Right. That's very interesting. And you were saying that Prince Naga is probably 300 years old?
No, I'm saying he's probably 150 or so, I'm guessing. I've lost track. There's a senator who spoke at a conference that was held in Iran in 1971, and it's one of my favorite quotes. He was 300 years old at the time of that speech. I don't think he's alive anymore, but yeah. It's a very moving.
Okay, I'm confused. Who was 300 years old?
Okay. There was a Senator Mokga who gave a speech at an interspecies conference in Iran in 1971, 10 years after the conference in England that I talk about a lot when Mark was a little kid. So this Senator Mokga was a raptor senator. He was 300 years old at that time, and he gave a speech, and there's a quote from his speech that I use most of the time when I speak, because it's very moving. That's what I'm saying. I know they do live to be several hundred years old, or they can live to be several hundred years old.
So these reptilians have senators just like we do?
They do. Well, I don't know their whole system. They're run by an empress, so they have a caste system. They do have an empress. They have royal families, but they do have a senate. So they, whatever their senate does, you know, they go and discuss things. You know, I imagine, and I'm sure the empress listens to her senators. I'm sure the final word is hers, but. You know, Mark and I haven't spent a lot of time discussing their government, but I do know they have senators.
Do the raptors have a senate here on the earth, a government here on the earth as well?
No, I would say they have ambassadors here. They do have ambassadors here. I mean, the empress is far, far away.
Do they still consider the earth their home?
They consider it to be their mother world, yes. This is where
mother
they
world.
Originated. Yeah, they distinguish the two. Earth is their mother world. Wherever their empire is their home world because they've been away for so long. And Naga's family line like can trace his lineage back to like the British Isles because that's where his lineage came from. So they like, you know, he loves to go to the British Isles for vacation and stuff. And their kids like to look for the fossils and things that would say, oh, look, you know, our folks were here type of stuff. So just like we go look up family history.
Do reptilians play a role in our government right now?
Well, which kind of reptilians?
Any.
The raptors do work with our military.
Mm-hmm.
The raptors do help defend the planet from whoever.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that their distant, whatever you want to call them, there's a group of reptilians called the Reptoids who, after the asteroid hit, some of the raptors that were left here evolved into a more human-looking creature. And they
mm-hmm.
do walk upright, and they don't usually have their tail anymore, and they still have three toes, but they don't have the long snout that the raptors do. So if you saw one at a distance, you'd just think that was a very tall human coming towards you.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to work with certain New World Order groups, so there might be reptoids working with, you know, either in our political system or different corporate systems. There have been, you know, reptoids make deals with whoever. The reptoids certainly are backing ISIS at this point, and I'm sure they're backing the guy in Korea, North Korea.
So does your husband's point of view coincide with David Icke and the fact that some of these ruling elite are actually reptilians, or is that not true?
No, we do not agree with that.
Okay.
No, we do not agree
okay.
with that. Yeah.
So,
I mean,
I'm
very vocal about, especially when I'm in England. Mark knows the current royal family, and you know he knew them all pretty well. I don't know how well he knew Charles, but he worked with Prince Philip. He knows the Queen. He knows, I don't know how well he knows the kids, but. You know, he knew the Queen Mum and certain other people that worked with Mark, you know, are very well acquainted with them. And they have raptors and other species, you know, just ambassadors from other species are there at the castle and, you know, the different places. They're in Balmoral. They're all over the place, and they have meetings. Maybe sometimes it's underground. But that doesn't mean that they're reptilians or they're something else. The fact is that you have ambassadors and other representatives from alien governments who come and have meetings with heads of state, be it England or other countries.
So these reptilians are not the shapeshifters that David Icke says they are.
Well, I'll be honest, I have never listened to a lot of David Icke's stuff.
Okay.
But so I'm not sure what kind, and I don't know if he identifies a specific type of reptilian. Maybe you know. The little bit I've heard, you know, then I just stop listening because I don't have time to listen to everybody else. No offense. so I don't know what type he's talking about, but I do know that it's very difficult for most species to shapeshift because you're changing atomic structure. So
right.
you can't do it easily, and a lot of them don't have that ability. There's only a couple. There's only one that I know for sure that can shapeshift, and they do regularly, and it's not a reptilian. A lot
okay.
of them can maybe project a holographic image so that you think they're looking human, but they're not. They can do that. But a lot of species, just like us, we can't shapeshift at the drop of a hat.
What alien type actually does shapeshift?
There's one called Jotun, J-O-T-U-N. And I think their basic form, they're like a rock. And what happens with them is if you're a baby Jotun, you're small. And as you get older, you're bigger. And if you want to shapeshift, you have to shapeshift into the size of something that would be relative to, like, your age, your Jotun age. So if you're a small Jotun, you would be a small rock. You would be a small piece of furniture, a very small human, just something very small. Now, if you're older, you could be like a huge boulder or maybe a small building or a sofa or a bigger human. So, and they pretty much consume everything that they come across. They're not friendly. One of the missions Mark dealt with, you know, we had a base on the moon in the 70s, and there were some Jotun there, and they attacked our Marines. And at first, you know, they felt a little rumble, like maybe a very small earthquake, and they didn't think anything of it. But later, you know, all of a sudden the men are screaming, and they're, you know, getting smashed by boulders and these weird things. But I've also read Mark's reports where, like, Naga was on a plane one time, and all of a sudden either the sofa in the plane or maybe the seats, you know, came alive and they turned into a raptor, even though it wasn't really a raptor. But, you know, it had just eaten one of his mates and was coming after him. And it's like, oh, you know, 2 seconds ago you were a sofa and now you're this, you know, bad, nasty thing. So,
So they're not to be do we with. Still do we still have a base on the moon?
Well, that's one thing the captain has not confirmed. I agree with most people that there definitely are still bases there. I hear a lot of talk about the Germans probably have a base. That's probably one of those things that if we do, it's U.S. military, and he can't tell me. He can't confirm or deny that, because if it's U.S. military, he can't talk about it. So I'm not sure. But I firmly believe that there are bases up there. I just don't know who all they are.
Do you think we will go back to the moon?
I hope so. But the thing is, you know, the aliens, even though the moon is, you know, within our solar system, so we have the territorial rights to it, but there are numerous alien species that have bases up there. But generally, and it's come out at these conferences, the aliens are not happy that we go out into space, number one, because we want to defend the planet. Imagine that. And we also want to mine the riches that are out there that they're already mining. So they don't want us horning in on their mining plans. And they don't want us knowing where they are. They do not want us, oh, look at that nice planet, and go out there and discover that's where this cool species lives. They don't want us coming out there on our vacation. So there you go. they're just not happy with us going out into space. But I think the plan is for the government to allow us to do that. So who knows?
Did we really go to the moon back in the late 60s and early 70s?
Yes, we did. And we were going there before that. You know, Rand Corporation built a rocket for the Air Force after World War II, and then in the late 50s, one of Mark's, like, great uncles or somebody and a British scientist, they developed these Orion-class spaceships that, you know, Mark has used, and there was a whole fleet of them. But, you know, we've been, when Mark was a kid at the England conference, the alien children that he was around were saying, you know, well, we know that you guys have been going out into space for years. And this was 1961. And in 1960, now I love this, in 1960, Mark Stanley had just moved to England because his dad was stationed there for a while. And Mark would go around to the different bases with his dad, just to do something interesting. And also his dad loved for him to, like, test their, you know, the different bases security. So he got away from the airmen one day, and I don't know what base he was at, but his dad finally finds him, and he's in, like, this code-breaking room. And he's going, Dad, and this is 1960, he goes, Dad, they're talking about being on the moon and on Mars right now. Yes, son, they are, but, you know, we can't tell anybody that. It's like, so we were already there in 1960. So,
huh.
And I'm sure he was talking about hearing that humans were on the moon and Mars. So, yeah, we've been going out to space for a long time.
Recently, a CIA or an ex-CIA guy, Robert David Steele, says that we have a base on Mars with 10,000 people, and for some reason, these people are not allowed to leave Mars. They're kind of stuck there. Have you heard anything about that?
No, because Mark can't talk about Mars. For whatever reason, I'm assuming it's because that was under his U.S. military service. So he knows about Mars, but I get this look that he gives me when he can't talk to me about something. So that's one of those topics. He has only said, I can tell you that, yes, the reptilians or a reptilian group has a base there, an insect group has a base there or had. He goes, so you can imagine there's probably some humans. Now, one thing he told me recently about the secret space program is that a lot of times when guys come out of combat and maybe they've been too traumatized by all the alien activity they've just seen and they're not supposed to talk about, you're given three choices. You can have your mind washed, or you can, you know, promise upon pain of death you're not going to say a word, or you can sign up for the secret space program. So I wouldn't be surprised that there are a lot of humans out in space. And sometimes when there's a helicopter that has a crash in Louisiana, you know, maybe those guys just went off to the secret space program. Because accidents aren't always real, and you can fake accidents. And he won't talk to me about, you know, the ship that got rammed recently out in the ocean and some of the Navy guys died. He won't talk about that. He'll just say it's pretty suspicious. But he has told me, and I go, well, can I say this? And he goes, yes. And it's like, so one of the ways people get out into the secret space program is because they're so traumatized or they've seen too much and they're really good at what they do. So maybe they volunteer too.
Has your husband ever talked about William Tompkins?
Well, one of the interviews that Carrie Cassidy came and did, probably not the last interview, maybe number five, if she's about to do number seven next weekend. But she
really?
Came and told Mark about this guy that she'd met and interviewed, and he had some really interesting information about his Navy experience. And so I know she sent Mark his book, and Mark did say that he's got a lot of truth in there, and it's always good to, like, follow the money. And I don't know that if all his facts are exactly correct, but he did, you know, say there was a lot of good information in there. So, and I was just at the MUFON symposium last month, and I know Bill Tompkins was there speaking, but I stayed at my booth, so I didn't hear any of the speakers. But
oh, that's too bad.
Yeah,
he's a pretty interesting guy. Now, what are your husband's thoughts on Corey Good?
Oh, I knew you were going to go there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll be very kind because I don't like to disrespect anybody in this industry.
Sure.
And here I'm saying, Mark gets transcripts of every interview usually that Corey does. He's got a friend that sends him the transcripts of all the interviews. And he has said, and again, no disrespect to Corey because I've never met him, and he was also at the MUFON thing, but he never came to his table, so I could never actually see who he was. But Marcus said in the beginning, a lot of his information was truthful. He said lately, not so much.
Oh.
So.
A little exaggeration maybe here.
And what I hear also from other UFO people in the industry that I know, and they're also, you know, good researchers and whatever, and they go to a lot of these conferences, he apparently is using a lot of other people's information and maybe not giving them, not saying it's necessarily his own, but maybe not giving them credit.
Right.
So I don't know, and again, I'm not out to put anybody down. I'm just saying Mark doesn't fully validate what he says.
Sure,
and sometimes
sure.
People get planted memories, things like that. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely. So there was also something that you were specifically going to tell us about tonight or you were thinking about chatting about?
Sure, right. The Raptor training program that Mark was involved with as a teenager.
Right, right. Cool. Let's go on that for a little bit.
Let's go on that. All right. And are we going to is this a 1 hour or 2 hour show? I forget.
Just 1 hour.
Okay. Well, we can probably do this in the next half an hour or so. So in the summer of 1970, and this really goes along with, I loved the theme of MUFON's symposium because they were talking about, you know, the secret space program being kind of a blending of aliens and humans working together and all that. And more the things that Mark shares with me, I mean, that is true. And I will put a plug in for myself. I'm going to be speaking in L.A. this coming week, Tuesday night. I'm at a meeting called UPARS in Studio City. And in Wednesday night, I'm giving a talk to MUFON Orange County chapter and about the secret space program that Mark's been involved with. So it starts with his biography, goes into his training, goes into different missions he's been at, these conferences he's been involved with, because it's all part of the big program that he was involved with. So I wrapped that talk up today. But so anyway, in the summer of 1970, Mark was privileged to be part of a Raptor training facility in northern England. And I don't know if anybody's heard of Bamburgh Castle, but it's a pretty cool castle close up to near Scotland. It's in northern England, in Northumbria. And it's like sits on the ocean. So it's a very good place to like hide visitors you don't want humans to see, and for people to like maybe that have to come in from the ocean or whatever. And there's lots of nice meadows for things to run around on. And the hope was to create a bond between the Raptor Draconian Empire and the humans. And it was a big step in that direction. And Mark was going to be one of the human cadets. So now imagine this is 70, so this is like the year before he graduates from high school, and there were other humans involved in this program, and he didn't mention a lot of names, but Dean Martin's son was one of them. I do remember that. So let's see.
Hmm.
Actually, I'm going through my PowerPoint that I have on this. So beautiful castle. That's one of the parts of England I have not been to yet. But one of these days I will get there. So this training program, you would attend classes, you trained in simulation machines. You at the end of the program, they were going to do a war game out in space. They got training in suppression of enemy space defense, space strike, all kinds of, you know, space stuff because the Raptors are a spacefaring species, and they have cool ships. So, again, you know, my husband loves to play and run with his friends, and he's really smart, so this was right up his alley. But it was really hard for some of the Raptors to accept the humans as part of their imperial fleet because they never really think of humans as equals. So this was a big test. And so Mark and some of these humans were guinea pigs, you know, like, can they pass the test? Now, the Raptor officers were expected to care for their forces and to prepare them, and they were expected to make right choices and win wars. And again, as I'm describing some of this, think of the beautiful velociraptors in Jurassic World. I love that movie. I know there's a part two coming out. I don't know when it is.
Can I throw in a question real quick? You were saying Dean Martin's son.
One of them, yeah. One that died, like got killed by the freeway or whatever.
Oh, so he died.
Yeah, and it's just been in the last, I don't know, 10 or 20 years that he died. It's been since I've known Mark that the guy was killed. And I don't know if he was, like, parked on the side of the road or whatever, but I think he was shot. I don't think it was just, like, an accident or anything. I think he was shot. But, he was there with Mark. Because a lot of the actors and a lot of the people in show business are also, like, undercover agents. So, you know, Oliver
Is
Reed
that
was
right?
a British agent. Oh, yeah. Oliver Reed was a British agent. Tom Mix was a cowboy actor, but he was also an agent for the U.S. government. So, yeah.
Any other ones that you can speak about?
I would like to think John Wayne might have been in the know, but I can't be sure. You know, Howard mm-hmm. Hughes wasn't an actor, but he was certainly in the know on all this stuff. A lot of them are, or at least a lot of them have been. So I don't have a lot of names off the top of my head.
Do you think Howard Hughes, I know near the end of his life, he kind of lost his mind to a degree. Do you think part of that may have been because he had to deal with knowledge? He knew a lot of things that he couldn't tell
people. It's hard to deal with. Yeah, it's hard to deal with. It can drive you crazy. Well, in fact, P.K. Dick, the science fiction writer, he was totally in the know with this stuff and was a remote viewer for the military. It drove him nuts. Because of all the stuff he saw.
Wow. You know, I tell people.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I tell a lot of times I will tell guests that I don't think, I don't know that a forced disclosure, like necessarily the president or the vice president or somebody like that, getting up and talking about this kind of stuff, I don't know that that's always a good thing because.
No.
There's a lot here to deal with, you know, not everyone's ready. You know what I'm saying?
No, they're not. And, you know, I think it's a soft disclosure, and that's what's happening. Because the government, you know, the political people, they can be killed off if they start talking before it's time. There is a definite timeline to set a date for disclosure, and it's not for years away. So the more we can do out here in the trenches, this grassroots effort that we're all working on to share this information, the better.
Right. And I like your term soft disclosure. That's very good.
Right.
That's a because very good way to put it.
Yeah. People can either believe us or they can look at me and think I'm nuts. So it's like, and I don't care.
Right. Exactly. Now you were talking about a science fiction writer, P.K. Dick.
P.K. Dick.
He was completely in the know.
He was in the know. He was a remote viewer for the military.
Mm-hmm.
Mark knew. He was a friend of Mark's. I don't know a lot about him, but I mean he's a famous science fiction writer, so you could go look him up. But he, you know, I don't know if he committed suicide. I don't know how he died. I can't remember because that's not important. But I know knowing a lot of this stuff, and as a remote viewer, he saw a lot of stuff that was pretty traumatic. And I think in one of Mark's reports, you know, P.K. Dick is having a vision of 9/11 years before. I mean, like the aftermath, like there's no towers there. And I mean, he could see that something was going to happen. So that it's just he was valuable, but he did go. It was very hard.
I got a couple quotes here from P.K. Dick. He said, "Reality is that which, when you stop believing it, it doesn't go away." He also said, "It is sometimes an appropriate response to reality to go insane."
Oh, poor guy.
He also said, "Don't try to solve serious matters in the middle of the night."
No.
So
I never met him, but Mark was good friends with him.
And he died in like 1982, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is not that far ago, really.
No.
So he kind of went insane near the end of his life then, right?
Pretty much. And I think he had a history of drug use as well. And probably to, you know, help him deal with the stuff he knew about.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I don't know a lot about him. Mark has written a lot about him in some of his different reports, but I don't retain everything like Mark does immediately.
So, he wrote Blade Runner and Total Recall.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I wonder if, well, you said he was in the know. I wonder if some of these movies were based on things that he knew.
Probably.
Very interesting.
A lot of times the filmmakers are given information to see how well the public will react. So.
That's so interesting. Very interesting. Sorry for that side tangent. I have a,
okay.
a way of going on this. I derailed you there. Get back to your story.
It's
sorry.
Okay. So anyway, the Raptors, the cadets, be it Raptor or humans, they went through this extensive training process. And one of the parts is the Raptors like to run. They also needed to train and to run in formations. And there's a great scene in Jurassic World with the human hero riding his three-wheeler motorcycle thing while the Raptors are running along with him. And Mark used to do that with his motorcycle and his raptor friends, either here in Marin and also in England, and they would run in formation and try to be as close to him as possible, and he just loved it. He just loved it. But the raptors are always running, and they're full of energy, and that's how they are. What's cool is, because, again, I bring up this movie a lot, Mark has a jacket just like the bomber jacket that the guy wears. And you can see, and I've got a picture in my PowerPoint, when they're doing the motorcycle scene, the raptors' heads are down. Some of them are down when they're running, so they do run like a T. So let's see what else happened. So when it came time for this war games, they were supposed to go out by Saturn and just do like this cool war games, and they're what do you call them, professors, trainers, they tried to train them for, you know, space is a scary place, and you can't teach everybody everything they need to know about going into space, so they tried to prepare them as much as possible, but their big test was going to be at an area near one of Saturn's moons. And they knew they had to be alert for privateers that were out there, other aliens. And as their trainers and teachers taught them, space is not a forgiving place. Mark was warned by his girlfriend that something bad might happen out there, and she was not happy he was going. But part of the Raptors' testing was to see if they could leave everything behind and go do their duty, especially when it was under stress. And, you know, being the honorable military man that he is, yes, he went and did his duty. Now, at the meantime, you have Mark's dad and Prince Naga at Menwith Hill, which is a base in England, and it was a communications base and an electronic monitoring station. It was also a base for where the NATO could work with raptors and other alien species. So the fathers could kind of watch what was going on. And they were flying, the cadets were flying an older raptor ship called a Moon Dart, which is pretty cool. I mean, I know a lot about their upgraded ships called a Moon Storm, which is really sexy and cool. But the Moon Darts were cool, and they were tough. And here is my husband and a few of these humans working with the raptors flying alien spacecraft. So they went through a portal near Saturn's North Pole. And so now they're out in space, and they see this cruise liner. So I know this sounds funny, but the aliens do go on vacation, and there are alien cruise liners running around in space showing the aliens lovely sights and the other planets, because maybe you're from this other planet way over here, and you want to go see Saturn. And so they pass this cruise liner full of alien tourists. So that was pretty funny. And there's actually a cool image of that on the internet that I found. And now, one of the rules of the war game was that no alien civilization was supposed to see or record the armed military spacecraft because you didn't want enemies misinterpreting it that they were coming out there to do battle. So Mark decided they would go to a different training range that was technically off limits, but they went there anyway. They had formations of 3-9 ship Vs, and they deployed some targeting drones. So they did this whole holographic war game thing, and it was a battle scenario to test their skills. And they won, because one of the reasons they won, because Mark does think out of the box, and he was using some of his human warfare tactics that he knew about that maybe the Raptors wouldn't have normally used. So they actually won their war game, and that was pretty cool. So the next they go out, again, like in Star Wars, you know, those cool bars in space, the clubs and things. They have things like that out there, and they went to a support ship that reminds me of the bar in Star Wars. So they could, you know, rest and eat and just catch up on their sleep or whatever. And it was also a munitions and weapons loading place. Well, because of the equipment that was on that support ship, Mark and the other cadets learned that the Trogs, which is a nasty insect species, had attacked that tourist liner that the guys had just seen, and it was sitting dead in space. So, again, being the honorable military guys that they were, they had to go rescue the innocent tourists. So they shoot off from this support ship and go out and attack the Trog ship, and they have a big battle. In the end, they're aided by a raptor ship, a bigger raptor ship that comes and helps them that was nearby somewhere. But at one point, it says, with 14 ships left, Craig, who's Naga's son, and Mark led their crews on a full-scale attack of the enemy base. They all expected to die that day, but suddenly the Trogs were turning away as a raptor heavy cruiser came to their aid. And so they went to the cruise liner. And it was great because even though the Trogs had attacked and they were trying to board, none of the passengers died because they were fighting back against the Trogs, which was great. Of the original 27 Raptor crews, 21 crews survived. And a great quote by Mark, they lived free and full lives, died fast as great heroes of the Empire, bringing fame and wealth and honor to their clans and families. What more could any dragon ask for? And yet, you can't help but think how much we lost with their passing. These are my friends, in so many ways, my brothers. And my husband was 17 when he did that.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask. What time frame was this?
He was 17 because it was 70. He graduated from high school the following June, 71. So he would have been about 17 at the time. And here he is flying off in space at 17, working, training with the Raptors. And it's not a super long report. It's one of the shorter reports that I have. But, of course, it's full of more military information and lots of descriptions about how they the training that they offer and their belief system about being an officer and being in the Imperial fleet and what a great honor it is. And it's just a great example of humans and aliens working together. It wasn't, you know, a U.S. military operation. It was a combined effort, and it was run by the Raptors. So
Did you say that somebody named Craig was Naga's son?
Well, his name is Craig. I can't, and
Craig.
It probably is pronounced Craig, C-R-A-G, Craig, was one of Naga's raptor sons, and Mark met him in 1961 at the England conference, and they became really good friends. And so later on, you know, they grew up to do missions together and whatever, and then Craig was killed in combat in 1979. So.
Do these raptors lay eggs like a normal reptile?
They do lay eggs. Yes, they do. They lay a clutch of eggs. Sometimes it's 3 or 4, you know, maybe 5 or 6. They're not like, I don't know, maybe some of them do more than that. But especially when it's their first few clutches, it might only be a few. But, yeah, they do usually have more than one at a time. So you can have lots of kids as a raptor.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Naga has
big
lots
family.
Of kids.
Wow, wow.
Yeah.
Well, Joanne, the whole hour has gone by so quick. I want to give
know.
You a chance to tell people about Earth Defense Headquarters and whatever else you wanted to close the show with. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, like I said, I have a nonprofit. We have several reports about the space program, the military space operations, and these similar things to what I've been talking about, lots of missions that my husband's been on and whatever. So my website is edhca.org for Earth Defense Headquarters, California. And all the reports are on there. I have lots of TV shows that I did that are on YouTube from Project Camelot Network, and of course lots of radio interviews. And Mark Schneider here has been one of the kind hosts who's had me on many times, so I appreciate that. So happy to answer questions. My email's on there, so happy to answer anybody's questions.
Well, thanks, Joanne. It's always a pleasure to chat with you. Have a great evening.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.